From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll speak with a Wisconsin environmentalist about how to tackle climate change in a time of political divisiveness. Then we'll learn what makes for an easy walk and how two sisters created a guidebook for accessible walks around Milwaukee.
Jenny and I both like walking in parks, and I mentioned the project to Jenny, and I think we kind of weighed the possibilities of like, well, do you think we could find 50 fun walks in the city of Milwaukee? And then we set out to see if we could.
Plus, we'll hear from Milwaukee historian John Gerda about his experience homesteading and nature's resistance to being tamed.
The real basic mistake we made, put in the story, was we failed to reckon with the awful fecundity of nature.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. With a new president comes a new approach to climate change, one that is drastically different from the current administration's policies and goals. President-elect Donald Trump has said he wants to do away with regulations intended to cut carbon emissions and has promised to weaken or eliminate federal rules aimed at slowing climate change. But the work to find global solutions to climate change continues. This week, there is an annual gathering of 200 countries from around the world meeting to discuss how to tackle climate change. Tia Nelson is a lifelong environmental advocate and the daughter of U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day. She tells WUWM Susan Benz, climate solutions can only be found through collaboration.
I became quite focused on going to Washington. I had this really naive idea that I could travel the world and help save the planet, which is a pretty silly concept if you think about it. And I managed to get a job in the Government Relations Office at the Nature Conservancy. And I worked for them for 17 years, first in government relations and public policy, and later in the Latin American division, and then finally working at the intersection of conservation and climate change. And I became their first director of their climate change initiative and led that work from the very beginning. And it's grown leaps and bounds since I was there, and is now very much a part of everything they do. But it was not at the time. And so that was an interesting challenge and an interesting opportunity.
Is that a period of time that you felt as though there was traction, there was a real possibility that climate policy would take hold in a meaningful way?
It's interesting to note, in 1992, I traveled to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, for the Earth Summit. And the Framework Convention on Climate Change was signed there by, I'd have to look up how many signatories there were, I think 192 signatories. George Herbert Walker Bush was present, signed the Framework Convention on Climate Change, and said the following words: "The United States will lead the world in addressing this existential threat." That was an exciting and hopeful moment. Think of it. This is a Republican president pledging to cooperate with 190-plus nations around the world to address this, really the greatest environmental challenge of human time. And so in the years that came after that, there were, and continue to be today, annual meetings with the kind of goofy name Conference of the Parties, in which nations gather and try to figure out how we can address this global threat, meet the challenge, and find the opportunities to build a future in which we can all thrive. And it's been a very long journey, and we're not where we should be. We're certainly not where I would hope we would be, and we've had a lot of missed opportunities, and we're running out of time.
You mentioned the promise of that time.
Mm-hmm.
What have you seen happen since then?
Unfortunately, I think we find ourselves at a significant inflection point in history, certainly in my lifetime, both in terms of the political divisiveness that impacts a multitude of policies, where it used to be possible for Democrats and Republicans to work together to find solutions and compromise, and that seems so difficult and challenging today. And this inflection point comes at a time where the urgency of action on climate change has never been more serious and more important. And so finding a way to engage citizens and communities in understanding the challenge of climate change and helping deploy the solutions, and we know what the solutions are and the technology is available, it is within our reach. Creating that political will is a challenge in this type of political environment, but I believe that we have opportunities to do that, and that is my focus. The question that I think about a lot is, environmentalists have been talking about the climate change issue for a long time. I've been engaged in international conversations and negotiations since 1992. I've worked at the local level, I've worked at the state level, I've worked internationally. We've been at this a long time. Why aren't we where we need to be? And I think we, as an environmental community, have failed in many ways to appeal to a broader audience, to appeal to people who don't get up in the morning and identify as an environmentalist. I've lived my life as an environmentalist, but many people have not. And yet, we are all dependent on clean air, clean water. We are all threatened, our livelihoods, our lives, our children and grandchildren. It's the biggest environmental challenge we face. And so you don't have to be an environmentalist to be impacted or think about this issue. So we have to find a different way, in my opinion. We really, as environmentalists, have failed to effectively communicate to a broader constituency, a broader audience, what the urgency is, what the solutions are, and how the average person can be a part of building that brighter future. And I think we can do it. I think we're in a time where the importance of individuals and communities and civil society to listen to each other, to talk to each other, to find common ground, to discuss our shared values, and look towards action and the future could not be more important than now.
Is part of the idea lifting up, encouraging, nurturing trusted messengers?
Well, I'm very interested in figuring out how we meet people where they are, identify common values, engage a broader community in a conversation around environmental solutions generally and climate change particularly. And I'm very inspired by what's happening in the faith community. There's a movement which I think is very important and very powerful called Creation Care. This is within the Christian faith. Talks about caring for God's creation. Those voices, and I was not raised in a religious family, though my grandmother was quite devout, my mother was not, but the promise of broadening the conversation and finding new language to talk about the awesomeness that is the natural world and any means by which we can get there is worth exploring. I am inspired by people like Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, who's a evangelical and head of the Nature Conservancy Science Program, Bob English, the former Republican congressman, who had a pivotal moment in his life in which he went from being a climate change denier to dedicating his life, creating a Republican-oriented organization and dedicating his life to address climate change because of an encounter that he had with a scientist who shared his religious values. So How do we identify trusted messengers in the community who can speak to a broader audience? I think that's critical, and it's not always going to be environmentalists.
As you've said, you've put in many years into the movement. It's easy to despair. So you really find promise in this approach.
I believe that if we can, as individuals in society, in our communities, spend more time listening to each other, identifying common value propositions, and having discussions and debates even about what the right solutions are to go move forward to address these challenges, I believe we can do it. I believe we must do it. It is the opportunity before us. And I think, in a way, the divisiveness that we're seeing in the political world makes this opportunity more important and more critical.
Because ultimately, we need masses to just demand that action take place, right?
Yeah. Well, elected officials respond to their constituencies. Certainly, that is the intended design of a democratic system. But government, elected officials have to respond to the people who elect them. And if we prioritize this issue, they have to be responsive to it. And not so long ago, I stitched together a series of YouTube videos in which the following people were saying climate change was an issue and needed to be addressed by Congress. And some of these names will likely shock your audience as much as it shocked me. Sarah Palin, Huckabee, Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney, and others, all, not that many years ago, stated the urgency of addressing climate change and the need for bipartisan collaboration around that issue. Now, these people that I've named are pretty conservative, and they're all Republican. John McCain was in there as well, and he was a great leader on climate change. So it wasn't that long ago that Republicans were talking about and helping lead on this issue. And I believe that's possible again. It will take time, and it certainly will take the engagement of the citizenry to demand that of its elected officials.
Tia Nelson is a Wisconsin environmentalist who serves on the board of Eco America. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. One of the simplest ways to get outside is to go for a walk. There's a book that goes back to the basics of just taking a walk in the park. It's called Easy Walks and Paddles in Milwaukee. Sisters Karen and Jennifer Lemke went to over 50 parks to find friendly walks, noting things like accessibility, bathroom access, and whether they're easy to get to on the bus. With their book, the sisters hope to serve people with mobility issues or visual impairments, as well as elders and parents with young kids. WUWM's Lena Tran went on a walk with the Lemke sisters in Bayview's Humboldt Park. But first, she speaks with Marjorie Turner Holman, the editor of the Easy Walks series.
There's a few things that make a walk an easy walk. The idea comes from Marjorie Turner Holman, a writer in Bellingham, Massachusetts, who edits the Easy Walk series.
Not too many roots or rocks, relatively level with firm footing, and something of interest along the way. Water views, cool rocks. Has nothing to do with distance because that's individual stamina. For any of us like me who has mobility challenges, trail surfaces make the difference whether you can access an area or not.
30 years ago, Holman had a life-saving brain surgery that left her paralyzed on her right side. Easy walks became a huge part of her recovery journey.
I overlook a lake here in Bellingham And there's a little dead end road. I walked there almost daily, walking as far as I could, typically walking with friends. It was about 7 years of just walking in one place.
For Holman, walking wasn't just about physical health. It was a meditation on the world around her and what it means to be able to move.
I don't love exercise. I love being out in the world. I love what it does to me to just be outdoors, feel the wind, hear the birds, see the little changes. When you're there every day, you really do see those. You know, they're just, there's a lot if you're willing to look close.
Holman and Karen Lemke met online in a Zoom meeting last year. Holman had been wanting to add an urban field guide to the series. Until now, most of the books have been focused on Massachusetts, where she lives. I recently met Karen and her sister Jennifer at Humboldt Park. Here's Karen.
I'll review a book. So as I was reading one of her other books about easy walks and paddles, I realized, oh, this is really interesting, and this is something Jenny and I both like, walking in parks, and I mentioned the project to Jenny, and I think we kind of weighed the possibilities of like, well, do you think we could find 50 fun walks in the city of Milwaukee? And then we set out to see if we could.
What has the easy walk come to mean to you after putting this guide together?
I feel like it's kind of synonymous with like disability rights, like, and the importance of thinking about all ability levels and all needs when designing public infrastructure like parks.
All the walks that you guys found are accessible by public transit. Yeah. Why was that such a priority for putting this together?
Yeah, my spouse and I decided to go down to one car like maybe 7, 8 years ago. So that's just kind of how I think and plan about getting things done. So when Karen and I started doing this project, it was like, well, that's how I'm gonna get to these parks. Like, I'm not gonna take our car when she's at work. And you know, that's not unique. There's tons of people in this city and outside of the city who are navigating without a car. So why wouldn't we focus on what's accessible to everybody?
We've also considered how public transit is part of just transition climate solution. And the more we can normalize everyone using public transit, to me, the transit system in Milwaukee is one of our greatest assets. It's one of, you know, the things that being able to get around without having to have your own car is part of what the future looks like.
So you mentioned, Karen, I think, that you guys would do this, like, you would choose a new park to go on a walk weekly and, like, take notes in your phones. Just tell me about the process of putting this together.
So Jennifer and I started researching parks, researching meaning going for a walk and then having a snack, researching parks in earnest in June and July. At first, I had printed out a bunch of pieces of paper for us to take notes on. And then I realized, wait, if I could do the, you know, if I could automate this somehow with our phones, that would make this a lot easier. And we'd also be able to include a snapshot, a photo from each of the parks. I made a Google form, and then we were able to do data entry, so to speak, which spit it all into a spreadsheet. And then also, because it was already like a data table and it had the addresses in it, I was able to put that into Google Maps, and then we now have an interactive map as well.
They spent the next 5 months scoping out parks together. The sisters took note of things like trail surfaces, nearby bus stops, whether there are bathrooms or benches to rest on.
I just want to point out, as we're walking on this paved path, we just walked over a section of repaired concrete. That's certainly a concern that comes up, is that paved areas are not going to be safe if they are not maintained paved areas. And people who use mobility assistance, if they have a wheelchair or a cane or anything, it's, you know, much nicer to have maintained spaces.
The sisters also describe interesting views and history and suggest nearby spots to get a bite to eat after your walk.
I love that you guys have suggested snacks for each spot because I'm very food motivated. Where did that idea come from? Because I don't think that was like part of Marjorie's initial like vision,
right? No, it wasn't. Because we would go and hit up two or three parks in a row and then be like, okay, I'm starving and we don't know this neighborhood, so where are we going to go now? And then we're both kind of health conscious people. I've been vegetarian for 14 years, so sometimes it's like, where am I going to go?
Yeah.
So we started like, okay, if we're going to go explore this neighborhood, where are we going to eat? Who's got the vegetables?
Yeah. As you're putting this together, did you observe anything about like where parks are in the city or whether some parks are easier to get to in some parts of the city than others?
Yeah,
you know, what were some of your observations?
For sure. So let me talk a little bit about Frederick Law Olmsted, who was the landscape architect who designed Central Park and the three early parks in the Milwaukee system. And he was very committed to accessibility, including transit accessibility. To him, it was also very important for people from all different social backgrounds, social classes, ethnicities. He had visited the South before the Civil War and had written about the conditions that enslaved people were in. Really was part of what groundswelled the abolitionist movement in the 19th century. Anyway, so there's some of that history underlies the patterns of our park. So there's some, you know, beautiful intentions 130 years ago that as the city built out, places that were kind of intentionally marginalized, redlined, and through deed restrictions and other kinds of racialized ways of sort of saying these places are for us and these places aren't for you, there are certainly places on the north and northwest side that, and the south side too, that have less access to parks. But in general, 90% of people in the city of Milwaukee have access to a park within 1 mile. And the 10% who don't are in predominantly African-American neighborhoods.
Did any work on this project change how you see walks in your life or see public parks in the city?
I feel more obligated to be more involved, I don't want to say politically, but like with the local government and preserving these parks. I think this project has really opened our eyes to just how much has been put into building this thriving, comprehensive park system. And yet you can see in the more underserved neighborhoods, it's kind of starting to break down a bit. And I just feel pressure to preserve what we've invested in, you know, and not let it fall into disrepair to the point beyond repair where people start saying, well, no, let's not give any money to the parks. Look what they've let happen to that park.
Karen and Jennifer say their book is a showcase of the city that they know and love.
Because I do get just tired of hearing the negative talk that comes from the suburbs, from people who don't know what they're talking about.
It's a simple field guide, but with it, they're honoring the city's history and sharing a vision for the future.
I've been thinking about like colonialism and the structures of sort of what's been built upon, you know, layers of civilizations built upon each other and how we erase, you know, culturally and its function of whiteness and all that stuff to just pretend that there was nothing in Milwaukee before Solomon Juneau got here. And so I also wanted to like tell the story about, no, there were amazing Native American villages here. A bunch of these diagonal roads, they are Native American walking paths that connect these ancient villages that predate Solomon Juneau by 200 years. We are a thriving multi-ethnic city, and I see that as such an asset. You know, I feel like that's the future that this is the city I want to live in. This is the kind of future that I want to build and work towards. And if this book can be part of the conversation about accessibility, about, you know, recognizing that we need to make sure that our built environment is inclusive of everyone, I'd be overjoyed if our book could do that.
That's Karen and Jennifer Lemke. Their new book is Easy Walks and Paddles in Milwaukee. For Lake Effect, I'm Lena Tran.
Karen and Jennifer Lemke made an online map highlighting all the parks they visited. You can find that at our website, wuwm.com. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll hear from Milwaukee historian John Gerda about his experience attempting to homestead in southwestern Wisconsin and how it led to a 130-acre fire. But first, we'll hear one woman's story of healing through nature at the Milwaukee Domes. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Just last week, the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors approved committing $30 million to restore the domes. For decades, Milwaukee's iconic domes have been a place to celebrate nature and explore distant biomes. But for Juanita Ramos, they're much more than that. They're a sanctuary and a place to heal. Ramos is a survivor of domestic violence. For years, she endured emotional, financial, and physical abuse at the hands of her husband. One day, it all became too much. She leapt out a second-story window in an attempt to escape. Ramos survived the fall with serious injuries to her foot. She found support and left her husband. And in the months of recovery that followed, she went to the domes daily. Years later, Ramos is an advocate and leader for other victims of abuse. She shares her story of nature and healing with WUWM's Lena Tran. A note to listeners, this conversation touches on domestic violence and may be sensitive to some listeners.
When Juanita Ramos walks into the Tropical Dome, her face lights up. This, she says, might be her favorite dome of the three. It reminds her of her childhood home in Puerto Rico. The heat and humidity are familiar, the colors are a celebration, vibrant pinks and purples, and the plants are dramatic. Palms the size of coffee tables, moss and ferns and vines everywhere. The room hums with life. We see a corpse flower when we walk in. It's the size of a toddler. It hasn't bloomed yet, so its petals are snug around its core like a buttoned-up collar.
Okay, so look at that. See? Something happens to you, like it just happened to me right now. And then look at this. Look at this corpse flower. I just... so unique. Wow. This tree here, we used to have about three in the back here.
In your childhood home?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's, I don't know how they call it in English, but it's guanabana. It's a, like a white pulp inside, and you take all those, the skin out, and it has little seeds, black seeds. And the taste of the guanabana is like, it's not too sweet, it's just perfect. And I can taste it just by looking at the tree. I call these rainbows because they got so many colors. To me, it reminds me of fall. They're so intricate. And if you notice, not all the leaves are the same shape or length. They all have something different. And to me, that makes it so special. So every plant has a, you can create a story out of it, out of every plant, out of every flower. And it really does something to you. Your mind really goes away from everything that's really bothering you, and you just concentrate and meditate. And you can inspire you to talk to your, you know, to your God.
More than a decade ago, Juanita would find solace here, doing this very thing. Because of her injured foot, she couldn't go far from home, but she could actually see the domes from her old house. She pointed the house out to me before we walked in together, a brown roof from her past, across the busy street.
I will come down the stairs, because I was living on the second floor. I would sit and sit and come down, not using my legs, but my bottom. Until I got to the bottom of the stairs, then I would just kind of do something funny to grab the wheelchair. And it was painful, but it was worth it because I was coming over here, and it made a whole difference in my life. And I did that for probably 7 months.
She said she would come and talk to the plants, and it's kind of like they would talk back and say, it's going to be okay. Things won't always be like this.
They were my friends at that time. If you talk to a human being, they'll say, well, if I was you, I would have done this, I would have done that. But if you talk to a plant, they just listen. They don't judge you. They don't tell you, well, next time you better, you'll know better. Nothing. It was just, okay, here I am, And so that's what I experienced. It was like, I had to come every day and sit here and cry and talk to the plants and just sit down and meditate. And I don't know if you've been in there, but there, when they have different flowers, it's like the scent of the flowers. It's like you can just close your eyes, relax, and smell all of that. And it does something to you. It does something to your brain. Because when you go through trauma, your head is like pitch dark. It just, you don't, it's like you lose that sense of understanding, even understanding yourself.
Juanita would bring her Bible to the domes. She lost herself in prayer. In the heat of the desert, the colors of the flowers, the heady scent of the rainforest. The plants she saw were beautiful, strong, thriving, things she wanted to be herself. She felt like she was in her own personal Eden.
Was your faith ever challenged in that dark time, or did it feel like you always had that?
You know what? I always knew that there's chaos around us, no matter what. And sooner or later, in a big or small degree, some of us are going to experience something in life that we don't never wanted to, experience. And so what do you do when something like that happens? It's power and choice, right? So you either sit down, get mad, angry, you blame everybody, including God, or you said, okay, I'm going to learn something out of this. And what I learned out of it, I'm going to share it with somebody and maybe help somebody not heal, because I don't have the power, but in the sense of healing, in the sense of having someone who will listen to you and would not judge you. And I grew up in Puerto Rico, and they have a lot of the same plants that I grew up climbing on trees. Can you imagine you going through a lot, and then all of a sudden you remember, oh, I remember when I used to climb on those mango trees and go up there. And so your mind starts moving, it starts going back, and things that you probably forgot, never talked about it, all of a sudden it comes alive because of what you're going through and what you experienced in the past. So the experience in the past and the one now connect, and somehow a healing process starts.
It took you back to that time before these terrible things happened to you,
mm-hmm.
and to the person that you were
mm-hmm.
before then.
Exactly. And guess what the message was?
What?
It's going to be better. It can be the same or even better. And yes, it is. It got better to the point that my backyard is full of flowers.
Even now, Juanita says, the body has a way of remembering things that you don't want to remember. When that happens, she comes back here or heads into her garden in the backyard. There's birds, butterflies, roses, lavender. She can spend hours there. Juanita sees messages everywhere in nature, signs of God's love and design. She tells me about this time that she was in Florida a few years ago.
And there was a tree that fell because of Maria, the Hurricane Maria, but a few of the roots were in the ground. And the tree was the base for other plants to grow and sort of remind me of me. And so I started to write about sometimes we fall, but falling doesn't mean that you just die. You can nurture others around you. Like this tree, it had like about 10 different plants. You know those spider plants? There were so many on it. And animals, like, you know, in Florida, there's all kinds of little animals, and they will go in there. And I just wrote a whole thing. Durante la tormenta, María, al árbol caído solo le quedaban algunas raíces incrustadas en la tierra.
She wrote about God's faithfulness. She believes that every flower is Him telling her, I love you, I have a plan. Even when you're in the desert, you are greater than your pain. And although you're in pain, you can help someone else heal. She wrote, even when you fall, you can help others get up. For WUWM, I'm Lena Tran.
Coming up next, we'll learn how a Milwaukee family spent 30 years trying to tame nature before learning to enjoy it for what it is. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. You may know John Gerda as a Milwaukee historian, but you probably didn't know that he spent 32 years attempting to homestead in southwestern Wisconsin. In many ways, the experience was a disaster. So much of a disaster that at one point he started a fire that burned 130 acres. Yet Gerda still remembers the experience fondly, and has taken a valuable lesson from the experience about his youthful hubris and nature's inevitability. Lake Effect Sam Woods speaks with Gerda about an article he wrote in Milwaukee Magazine about this experience.
Today, I want to talk to you about an article you wrote for Milwaukee Magazine called Driftless Dreams. Mm-hmm. And it's about your experience managing a plot of land in southwest Wisconsin for over 30 years. You know, read the article if you want the full story, right? But really quickly, what is the article about?
Basically, I've always considered myself a bi-coastal Wisconsinite. Okay. I was raised here in the shores of Lake Michigan in Milwaukee, but my mom was raised in a place called Coon Valley, Wisconsin, out mm-hmm. in the Driftless. So the Mississippi is kind of the other coast. And I've always had a real deep affection from the time I was probably in diapers, you know, mm-hmm. kind of going back to family reunions there. Certainly a lot of love for that area. And then the 1970s was a time when there was kind of a something resembling countercultural burnout, and there were mm-hmm. a lot of people kind of saying, all right, let's get out of here, you know, kind yeah. of leave the city. It was a back to the land movement, and that's national. I saw it in, you know, California, all the way from California to Connecticut. And I began to think about kind of reclaiming some of the rural heritage, you know, from my mom's side of the family. Her dad's name was John Johnson from Wisconsin. He had a dairy farm on the hills above Coon Valley. So that was something I always, at the same time, you know, during those years, I was kind of reclaiming heritage and kind of going back to kind of what my roots were, and those included the land. So after a good deal of looking in 1975, my girlfriend, who became my wife, we bought 30 acres in near a very small settlement called Bell Center, just a few miles south of Gay's Mills off the Kickapoo River. And we had that for about 30 years through three kids and a lot of trials and errors. So it was very powerful episode in my life. For all those years, and the first line in the story is, we made every mistake a city person could make. So it was, in a lot of ways, a lot of misadventures. But we grew and learned and changed, you know, as a result of those.
Yeah, and I do want to get into those misadventures, because there's some fun stories there. Mm-hmm. But
not at the time.
Not fun to go through, but fun to look back of decades later. But take me back to 1975 and your mindset. What were you trying to create? What was the vision?
At that point, probably 5-6 years out of college, and working for a youth center on Milwaukee South Side, and just starting, you know, to do some of the kind of Milwaukee writing I've been doing for the last 50 years or so. But this was kind of an attempt to reclaim my sort of geographic and ethnic heritage, you know, in the southwestern part of the state. And kind of the dream, if we had one, you know, was to have this kind of alternative rural reality as kind of a counterpoint to life in the city. You know, yeah. I love Milwaukee as well, but, you know, there's a whole part of me that is quite non-urban, and sort of feeding that was kind of the vision. And couldn't afford to buy the place we finally found by myself. So a friend from high school, Mike Rimmer, you know, he and I bought it together. And it still took us, it was $16,000. It took us 4 years to pay it off. So it was...
Hey. Good chunk of change.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
a little bit more in these days, I'm
right,
sure.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, so now we get to the fun stuff, which is when reality sets in, and right. that kind of that home away from home, or that oasis that you had in your mind, and it turns into, we'll say, a project.
A whole lot of work.
Yeah. But in the article, you mentioned wanting to have a vegetable garden, and there were some prairie lands that at the time the former owners cow herd,
right.
Cattle
beef
herd,
cattle, right.
beef cattle, yeah, were, you know, they were there. they were there doing their thing. They were eating, you know, eating the grass, eating, you know, almost everything.
And depositing used grass on the
used grass.
The land.
Yes, yeah, a little fertilizer.
Right.
And that didn't fit the vision at the time. At least their presence didn't fit the vision.
No, they were. They certainly did not much for the stream banks. No, they eroded the banks. And they actually, we had not been looking for a house, but there was a shack on the property, and there's an old portion that it was literally falling down. It was completely ruined. But there was a little 10 by 17 foot addition, you know, so it was about the size of a suburban living room, you know, and that was still there. The cows had gotten in, so there were smears of manure on the walls, you know, so we had a lot of cleanup
to do. Welcome home. Welcome back.
So it was kind of, the roof leaked, but we had not been expecting a roof, so that was fine. You know, we could sort of fix it up as best we could. So we evicted the cows, and I still have a sharp memory of a friend, a neighbor, Bill Hutchison, helped us build the fence, put up the fence, and we kept one section open, and I recall being there, and we kind of herded these very large animals, you know, under the neighbor's property, the people we bought from, and feeling, finally, you know, now it's just ours. And when we had first seen the place, it was a perfect park. It was grazed, you know, so the one thing they did not eat was daisies. They're bitter for cows. So this is, we saw that, I think, in June, and the whole property was covered with this waving field of daisies, you know, so it really was pretty idyllic. Yeah. And we had a vision of continuing that kind of rural idyll out there, and the first thing we did was to plant a garden, and just very tough, you know, quack grass sod, sort of dig that up, a 30 by 30 foot plot. And what we were doing basically was opening a wound in the soil into which all these green germs poured, especially box elder trees, but a whole lot of weeds, a lot of invasive species. So, you know, we're 3.5 hours away, so we weren't going to go out there at night, you know, and weed and water. So we go out there the first year, probably every 2 or 3 weeks. So it was hard to keep up with, and eventually it was just completely overgrown. We planted trees, you know, which seems ironic at the time.
Yeah.
When you look back
in a wilderness,
in retrospect.
Yeah.
Because the real basic mistake we made, put it in the story, was we failed to reckon with the awful fecundity of nature. Mm. You know, it abhors a vacuum, and it was really filling in, you know, that vacuum. So we had forest on two sides, and very slowly but inexorably, well, you have these forest plants kind of coming in to what had been the pasture land where the cows were. The cows had been the equivalent of fire. No, they had kept the brush down. When they left, it was completely open season. Mm-hmm. So we had this dream of reforesting selectively, and what happened was it got reforested very unselectively.
Right. Nature has other plans. This one's forest everywhere.
Yep. Yeah. So it just, you know, it sort of came in and overwhelmed the shade, overwhelmed anything we tried to plant. And perhaps the most kind of ambitious project was putting prairie in the bottomland, about 3 acres of bottomland there. And the area floods periodically. It's just what the driftless does.
Yeah.
So you have seeds being washed out. You have trees coming in. The plants are kind of out-competing, the prairie plants. So we tried to control it by fire. You know, that keeps the brush down. It worked well once. The second time it was a hot day in 1980, and we ended up burning 130 acres that weren't ours.
Yeah, that's quite a bit. That's a big fire.
Went all the way up to the old Highway 61, and we got our notice in the Crawford County Independent. Mm-hmm. So it was not calculated to kind of win the Good Neighbor Award, Crawford County. And the thing kept on burning, for the old deadwood, the old box elders. I remember being out there 2 or 3 weeks later, and there was still kind of, you look out at night, and there were still glowing embers in some mm-hmm. of the trees. So that was an unqualified disaster. So the word hubris comes to mind,
sure.
And I think we went out there with the illusion that we could master this land, mm-hmm. and pretty much the opposite, was what became the reality.
Well, and that's kind of what the, I guess a little bit of spoilers for the article, but it ends on that note of mm-hmm. of a what the limits that you can really do to tame nature, and even just
Absolutely.
Thinking in those terms of taming nature is just it's just folly.
Yep. Yeah, we're temporary. The land is permanent.
Yeah. Yep.
And what we do to it in our time can be it can be abusive. You know, it can be kind of ameliorative. It can help it. But we had this vision of kind of remaking it in our own image, which was very much a matter of hubris. So it was a long learning lesson, in some ways, but useful as well. It's kind of you think Aldo Leopold, the land ethic, you think of it as something to which we belong instead of something that belongs to us.
Sure.
So we came out there saying, this is ours. Yeah. And you kind of, in the years that passed, you realize, this is something that nature has a mind of its own.
Yeah.
And you are well advised to cooperate with it, and not try to master it.
Yeah. So you bought the land in 1975. And ended up selling it in 2007. So that's mm-hmm. that's 32 years
yep.
of adventures, we'll say,
right, right.
And lessons. And there's a lot of you talking about those lessons that you were just mentioning before about understanding what hubris looks like when it comes to relationships with nature. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit just to end us on a note of how you think of that experience today?
Sure. For more than 30 years, we had a front row seat at plant succession and how nature works. And one of the real high points there was we had 3 kids. And from the time they were in diapers to the time they were in high school, that was a favorite place for them. So it really gave them a grounding in nature. And all 3 of them, still look back on those years very fondly. Times when they could pretty much function independently. You can't let them go. You try to stay away from rattlesnakes, but otherwise they were pretty much free to go where they wanted. So those were really treasured times, for our family. But I think the larger lesson is the land itself was something that it was a lovely piece of property. Mm. And as I said in the article, there were times when the work was done, which was endless, And the kids were in bed where we didn't want to be any place else in the world. You know, that was just a fantastic place to be. Missteps and accidents and hubris aside, you know, it was a lovely place to have clear title to for 30 years. In time, you know, it did become, as the kids got older and busier, we got out there less and less. So we ended up selling that land and buying a smaller, much smaller and unmanaged piece of property up in the UP.
Let nature do its thing.
Let nature do its thing. Its own ancient devices.
Yep.
We learned that lesson. Where we are now, there are wild blueberries, and we have no visions of planting anything more ambitious than that.
Well, John, thank you again for joining us on Lake Effect and talking to us about those driftless dreams.
My pleasure, Sam.
John Gerda is a writer and historian. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods last year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. A new season of Bubbler Talk starts tomorrow. To kick off this new season, Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez explores if Milwaukee is a community of haters. And we still need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Also tomorrow, we'll follow up with two local election clerks to learn how things went on Election Day. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.